Quick review. Did the date sheet make it around?
Yeah.
Everybody get one?
What?
The date sheet. Did you get one?
I think I have one in there, I guess.
Yeah, I did.
For the next season. I put two in parentheses, see how we're going. As I said, I hope to get through this thing by before summer. So March 24th is the weekend of Thursday before Easter. And if it looks like we're going to get done, we could take a break then. And June 2nd, we may or may not need, depending on how much time we take. So. But I think you'll see we're going to pick up speed because we're going to be hearing the same thing repeatedly. Each parable is a repetition of this attempt to integrate the experience. Well, there's another twist, but the basic structure is the same, so we don't have to keep hounding that. We just have to look at where it's different.
And we just say we're going to meet next in 2 weeks.
Let's see. Yeah, that will be 16. That'll be the last before Christmas, and then we pick up on the
16th.
Oh, we pick up on the what is it? The 13th of January. Yeah. Is there anything else I said I would do? Oh, one detail from last time, before I get into the review. We got into that discussion about that quote, which Carol recognized as being from the Book of Revelation. And that was on page 256.
Oh, yeah, he's going to get 2 years.
And I thought, I finally caught Bonfant's making a mistake. And sure enough, it's page 71, it's footnoted.
Uh-huh.
That it is from the Book of Revelation and from Aurora.
Oh, good.
So I didn't get to feel superior. So it is both from Revelation and from Aurora. And I think the quote was what was the quote after?
Something about not crying. And death shall no more for mourning or crying or it was 23 or 27.
27?
20, well, anyway, the third one down on page 7.
Well, and death shall be no more, nor mourning, nor crying, nor sorrow shall be, nor sorrow shall be any more,
mm-hmm.
for the former things are passed away. And that's up there on page 256. The second line down in the first quote. And what we'd made of that was, you know, that chance. The Aurora puts it, using the Book of Revelation, as a once and for all.
Mm-hmm.
And we're saying it's a qualitative aspect of the experience. Okay, the review. We start off with Pally's dream to try to give you an idea of always examples for what this process looks like. And in that dream, it was preceded by a depression, which he described. And then that depression resolved itself in a dream, and that's what we're always trying to work for. Get that emotional state into an image. And the image was basically dual. Peter Strom, which we took as a self-image because it's a mixture of opposites. And a new professor was being chosen. So that in that depression was, behind that anxiety, was his new self. And that new self would be the new professor who was to lecture on different things. So that's what we mean by coming up from below. Through a depression, we've talked about it, through sexuality, through aggression, and through disease. I think they're the kind of the main new vehicles for the spirit. The image, again, in the next parable was the flood. It was on 244. We had the flood before, so that's nothing new. What we do get in this chapter is a clear indication that the flood comes from the experience. when the multitude of the sea shall be converted to me, and the streams that flowed over my face. So the link between the Sophia figure and the flood is just made explicit. Nothing new, otherwise. Kind of the big thing that we talked about for quite a while was on 245, this business of the arrows of my quiver drunk with blood. And the theme of the pregnancy on 247. That the death aspect of the experience from the point of view of consciousness is from the point of view of the unconscious impregnation. Shall I repeat that? Is that what you said? The death experience from the point of view of the conscious personality is from the unconscious personality, point of view of the unconscious personality, an impregnation. And that those death aspects are what are so hard about therapy. That means you have to go through depression. You have to go through loss. You have to go through boredom. You have to go through anger. You have to go through past hurts. And as far as you're concerned, it sucks. And that's where people will bolt. That's why the New Age is so popular, because you're promised salvation without the darkness. But we're looking at salvation through the darkness, but that darkness is only for the ego. As far as the unconscious is concerned, there's a fertilization through those experiences, and that is very, very hard to understand and to endure.
Right, it would be the same thing with Christianity also, because people are going flooding to the New Age, but it's not any different in Christianity either. They see God as light, love, not the darkness either.
Yeah.
You know,
depending on how you understand Christianity, I do think this is at its heart, which is that Christ didn't rise before he died, so that the death and rebirth theme is there. The problem is that that becomes a substitute for our dying and being reborn. And when he is reborn, he goes up. He doesn't stay here. So there's a discount to the value of reality. And salvation is seen projected externally. But depending on how you read it, I think you can see these ingredients in Christianity. But it is certainly, by the time Christendom got through with it, a much different story. Yeah.
How can you tell the difference between a depression that is going through the darkness and a depression that is failing to go through the darkness? The dreams?
I think, finally, I'd have to say the dreams. And in my position, I always watch the decisions that the person is making in that depression. That's another key, I think. When in the depression, self-destructive decisions are made, I think you're just dealing with self-destructive behavior. And indeed, sometimes we have to say to people, oh, for Christ's sake, quit bitching and go out and do something. Sometimes, however, you have to say just the opposite, embrace this thing and stay with it, and stay with it. Yeah.
Go to bed, curl up in the fetal position for a while.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is one of the trickiest parts of our work, how you manage this transition. And I don't see how anyone who doesn't have access to dreams can do it. Because they will tell you what's going on. Like in the Pali dream, you could see that the guy dove in the water. And then he came up. Well, that diving in the water, that's the depression. That's a loss of energy from consciousness. But what follows it is a rebirth. So in that case, you could say, complain all you want to, but don't get out of this mood. Because it stay in it until it tries to tell you something.
It's like cooking the vessel.
That is cooking in the vessel. Yeah, and then you got to watch, can the vessel hold or is there a leak?
So the complaining would not be a leak?
Not necessarily. I mean, it is miserable.
Yeah.
And I think you have to, I mean, you know, I don't like listening to it as much as anybody, but if you're an IGD, you have to scream. And the therapist has to endure it. And remember how it felt when you were there. I told you the one about my stinking office.
Stinking?
I tell you the story about my stinking office?
No.
No, a feet story is another story.
Okay.
I was working with a woman once who was going through this, and was really one of the most courageous journeys I've ever seen anybody take. She inspired me. She was beaten, screwed, parents were psychotic, and a well-functioning human being. But in the death process, what announced it was a decaying body. And then the next scene was of a resurrection. And in the dream, the decaying body stunk. And at this time, she was really miserable. Her marriage had fallen apart. She lost her job, one of those things. And she was just complaining all the time. And when she left one day, I noticed my office stank. And I opened up the windows, let air out overnight, came back. It smelled like rotting flesh. And that went on for about a week. What was so strange is nobody else that came into my room commented on it. And she came back the next week, and she had a dream then of resurrection, that the smell was gone. So that complaining and that death experience was so palpable, I could smell it, literally smell it, and nobody else could. So I'm thinking it was smelling it in relationship to her death. But that's what you have to go through with these people who are really, really dying and miserable.
That's empathy to them.
Well, I didn't choose to be empathetic. It forced itself on me.
You don't choose empathy. You choose sympathy.
Hmm.
Empathy happens.
It's nice. Anyway, so that's what this death thing is about, and that's crucial to the Sophie experience, because Sophie is a dark experience. It starts with a dark experience, and you have to be able to endure it if you're going through it. If you're a partner to somebody or in a professional relationship with somebody, you have to be there with them and feel that with them. The 10 virgins, 247, we talked about as the redeemed condition being accepting of all parts, the high and the low. Does that sound familiar? In the Bible, there were 10 foolish and 10 wise, and 5 were accepted, 5 were... No, yeah, 10 foolish and wise, 5 foolish, 5 wise. In the Bible, 5 are accepted, 5 aren't. Here, all are accepted. We also spent a great deal of time talking about the Son on page 249, the Son of Justice. We talked about the Son as an image of the self, and a son as an image of the ego. And the link between those two is if the ego is in alignment with the self, the illumination that emanates from the self will be the same illumination that emanates from the ego when they're in harmony. In other words, the way the self sees things and the way you see things will be the same. And that's what we're aiming for. We talked also a great deal about what does that feel like. It's not necessarily a bed of roses, but it is the experience of meaning. We talked about the tendency, again, back to regression on 251, where as soon as this thing starts creating images of the new state, he goes right to Christ, and therefore puts it back in the old paradigm. Page 253, we talked about the 10th groat, the 10th coin. And the idea there, again, is that the element that does it, that it's lost among many, that would be the dark shadow side if you take it as a metaphor, has to be included in the whole. And that's very much what this Sophia experience is about. Again, we have a regression because as soon as that theme comes up, what he talks about is the brethren, the community of believers. And I want to stress that we're not in any way saying that this work is antithetical to community. It's when you go to community as a substitute for your own development. So you flee into public opinion, flee into the comfort of the group, rather than become an individual who has something unique to contribute to the group. That's the big difference. That's where we left off, is on page 256, and I'll pick up there unless you have any questions. Well, we did briefly, so let's just touch on it. It is meet, therefore, my son, to make merry for this day, for there shall be no more crying nor any sorrow, for the former things are passed away. We already did that. But that's just to warm us up and remind us how this is depicted as a one-time event, because it's a quote from the book of Revelation, projected outwardly on the time, and not seen as a qualitative sense of renewal.
And Gary, you're saying that as far as that goes, and the depth of the experience, we go through and I mean, that maybe a different, I mean, it might even be something different in our life that we're dealing with.
It's a spiral.
Yeah, right.
It's a spiral.
It's kind of like the rebirth is the same thing. Mm-hmm. Resurrection is the same thing. It doesn't happen once. So,
not if you're not calcifying in your old age. Set in your ways. Playing golf in Florida. That's how I think of it. He that hath ears to hear. Second text quote on page 256. Let him hear what the spirit of the doctrine saith to the sons of discipline concerning the woman who brought in death. And put it to flight. See, that's the thing we're to meditate on. That this experience both brings death and brings rebirth. Which the philosophers declare in these words, take away his soul and give him back his soul, for the corruption of one is the generation of the other. Now, that the philosophers, of course, are always the alchemists. You see what they're driving at when they say, take away his soul and give him back his soul. For the corruption of one is the generation of another. What's that? Try that alchemically first. What's that? Yeah. First, let's try to get the alchemical reference straight. How does that work? Some of you did mysterium and
distillation.
Right. The alchemists, remember, started with this piece of base material, in which they thought there was a living soul. And they cooked it until it was distilled into a vapor. And it had to be driven off because the soul and the material in its profane state was corrupt.
Were you saying that the soul is driven off in the vapor?
The vapor is the soul. tonight, you can stand more than 2 hours of Jungian psychology in a day. I'll be showing pictures of that. How this first process is a separation of a non-material body, aptly represented by a vapor. I'm making it quite simple, so I don't want to get too far off on it. But and then this process has to be reheated, and the soul brought back into the material. So the idea is that this process is a transformation of your soul, which how would you put that in your own words? What does it mean to have a transformation of the soul? What is the soul? You know, when the most fearsome examiners in our training would say things like, now, Jung's concept of the anima or Jung's concept of of individuation. I see that guy over there in the next block sweeping the street. I want you to explain that so he can understand it. That's tough. How would you what is the soul to ordinary speech?
Emotion.
Yes.
Authentic feeling.
Yeah.
Authentic empathy. Authentic responsive instinct. Having dropped out of the cultural myth or cultural definition of what all that should be.
Mm. Anyone else?
It's your essence.
Yeah, that's what I can say.
Essence. There's not one right answer here, of course. I'm just trying to get us to put it. The way I think of it, and the best I can come to it, is whatever Motown music has, that's soul. It's an emotional quality. It's a relational quality. It's your authentic... the authenticness of your being there, it's what allows you to come into contact with another human being and feel connected and nourished. That's kind of how I try to understand it. And and why does it need to be purified? What state is it generally in?
Chaos.
Separation, authentic.
Yeah, and it's generally contaminated with power. Most of the time, if you look at normative interactions between two people, there's always a hidden agenda. What can this person do for me? And that's what has to be purified out. So that you relate to people simply to relate to people with no hidden agenda. And that's one of the things that comes out of this process. A service to the self, which is at the same time a purification of the soul. Because what you're doing isn't for your own hidden agendas, your own personal gain. You may gain by it. That can't be your intent. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why this image of the alchemy is put next to the image of the woman who brought death in and put it to flight. She's putting you... We're creating a more authentic selfhood, a more authentic ego, and that at the same time is a purification of the soul. And it's awfully hard to describe, but you know it when you feel it. When you're talking to somebody and you feel that emotional connection and affirmation and warmth, that's the soul.
I think the Kinsey movie does a great example of showing how that works sexually. So it's kind of a hard movie to watch, it works for me, but it's really excellent in terms of how culture repressed, constrained, distorted sexuality, and how normative responses in children, you know, instincts, were managed.
Come to think of that, I just saw an excellent movie. If you were looking to see a good movie, and they actually had it at Blockbuster, some of you may have seen it. It's Etre and Avoir in French. To be and to have.
Yep.
or to having to be, I forget which way it is.
Etre to be.
Is it Etre and Avoir? Not the order? Actually, kind of a blockbuster. And interesting on the soul thing for a second.
Is it in French?
It's in French, but with subtitles. And you couldn't believe it could be interesting. It is simply a movie of a school teacher in a one-room school in rural France and his relationship to those kids. It is so engaging. And it was interesting. I saw it with a friend who lives on the East Coast, and she had seen it before in Boston, where she said everybody knows about education. And she went into the bathroom after the movie, and there were some women in there complaining about what a lousy teacher this guy was. And if you take what you know pedagogically, he was. He held up work and had other students judge it. He was pretty directive, but he was pure soul. And it doesn't matter the mistakes he made, technically. His relationship to those kids was so vibrant that they flourished. And we live in a time where there is no soul. So that's why these, pardon me, I say, well, there's the animus for you. That's why the animus, all it can see is the technical mistakes and miss the fact that there was a living eros relationship between that man and the students. And if you have that, you can make all sorts of technical errors, and it doesn't really matter. So you can see that, and I think that's a very good example of a soul movie.
He did mention something, that he had other students comment on what the other students did or
yeah.
Did or something. That was very common when I went to school.
Me too. I mean, I think the new pedagogical theories say you don't want to set up a power conflict between the students.
Actually, I think it worked. I think it was good. But it's a different generation.
It's a different generation, and I don't want to get into the discussion of that, but just to see how where the soul is alive, you can make many mistakes, and it doesn't matter, because there is something mysterious, which mm-hmm. cannot be taught.
Kinsey's soul was absolutely alive, and he did all kinds of weird things, but he was so alive, so it's exactly that. Technically, he did some pretty funny things, but he was pretty out there, just being who he was.
The room is, what's where, in Bloomington?
Oh, it's here.
It's here.
It's a large release, so he never
called. I didn't know. So it was, okay.
You can think about your parents, too, and your children, in terms of...
Yeah.
You can make a lot of mistakes yeah. with them, but if you're...
And, you know, that also informs the way we do therapy. If the soul connection is there, you can say the dumbest things, mm-hmm. and it doesn't matter. It doesn't hurt. Mm-hmm. If it's not there, you make one mistake, and you've ruined the case. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, you keep saying this experience. You're talking about the Sophie experience?
Not sure what I was talking about.
Well, I mean, I hear you saying this experience.
Probably I'm talking about the Sophie experience. The Sophie experience, which has as one of its characteristics that your eros, your soul, is refined.
Okay.
Yeah. And dogs and children notice. Okay, let's see. 257. Take from him the corrupting humor and add to him the connatural humor through which shall come to pass his perfecting in life. And you see where I am? Bottom of 257.
Would you go back to the sentence before that?
Go ahead.
The same feminine personification who appeared previously, now as wisdom, and now as the soul of matter calling for help. Doesn't that fit today?
Mm-hmm.
Boy. all of this deep study all over the world, searching for the Sophia.
And looking for her in matter. I think that's our
absolutely
take on it.
Yeah. And in ourselves, we're matter. And we may be in the dung pile, but we'll crawl out of it.
Well, and it's in that pile that this experience can emerge. The corrupting humor is, the connatural humor, I didn't know that word, just, you probably didn't either, page 258, is meaning vivifying. So that quote really doesn't say anything new. Now, this next point is a little tricky. She wants us to reflect. You see there at the, page 256, the paragraph after the second quote?
256?
Yeah. In biblical language, the woman who brought death unto the world would be Eve. That's one sentence. She's just amplifying that sentence about the woman who brought death. I'm just trying to pick up the meat of this. And go to 257 now. About halfway down the page, from Mary arose the light. See where I am?
Yep.
From Mary arose the light, which scattered the darkness that Eve brought. And Mary felled the tree that brought death. Now, what's her point there in her reference to Mary and Eve, and why is that so important? Right.
I mean, the same.
Two sides of the same coin.
Right.
The two aspects of Sophia.
Two aspects of Sophia, which she wants us to realize in Christianity have been separated into two figures. You have Eve and you have Mary, the virgin and whore, which is the split in the feminine in Western civilization. It was about 2 years ago, I think, 3 years ago, in the Academy Awards, the winners were all about either prostitutes or saints. Mm-hmm. Women are either prostitutes or saints. So that sets the stage for the... what does it set the stage for? What makes this so miserable for women?
You're one or the other.
You're one or the other. And how does that play itself out in relationships? Let's say of a little girl. In the father-son relationship. What's so dangerous there?
In the father-son relationship?
Yeah, father-daughter relationship.
Depending on sexual or...
Well, the danger, I think, is this is what leads to the split anima in the man. I think the person who carries this is really the anima. The anima in the man. And the anima in the man will... focus on a little girl either as too pure or sexual. And what is missing is that center point where she is simply allowed to be a human being. So the what I think is so destructive about this is the effect that it has on the man's anima, then the effect that the projections from that anima have on women.
It will just be the reverse for women towards their sons, then. In a lot of ways.
I don't know. I think this is most destructive to women.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I think it is more common.
I mean, the mother's danger to the son is certainly there, but it's a different danger. Here, with women, the danger is that the effect of the anima projection of men on women, it creates a split.
This is what holds the honor in the family. Well, this is what we've seen: a woman's purity, her reluctance to power, and the need for virginity is what has carried the good name of the family.
The one side of it.
Centuries, right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's
right.
Up to her. And that was her source of power, is to stay pure and
yeah.
Avoid temptation. And, I mean, still it exists in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the man projecting back onto her.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where it comes from.
But so, can't women, don't women, as far as projecting their animus, wouldn't it be like more like power? Maybe not necessarily.
Yeah, I think it's a different projection. There
right.
isn't a split mm-hmm. in that woman's projection as there is in a man's projection.
But women definitely project that.
They project power. I think largely power.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's a unified projection where this is a split projection.
Gary, if just looking at this, how would you sort of explain in a young kind of way, like Eve ate the apple, Mary comes back, she felt that tree that brought the death, and she bears the fruit, which Eve ate the fruit. Mary bore the fruit. Is there some way?
Well, the problem is Mary's a virgin.
Right. And so, but it says there, and she bestows the fruit that makes us all rich.
Yeah, but she's a virgin.
So, okay, that's part of it.
I mean, can you imagine what Christianity would be like if it said, Yahweh came down, God came down, and they had one hell of a night, and out of that Christ was born. Can you imagine the difference in our civilization? That's what doesn't happen. That's the split. It's separated out from the body.
The
sexuality and the physical passion.
There's such a difference between Christianity and the Roman gods and,
yeah.
and such as. They were passionate,
and it isn't all Christianity, because I wasn't raised that way. I was raised with the integration of Christ as sexual.
Whoa.
So it's totally different. There are
certain it's unusual.
But it's unusual. Yeah, we were definitely heretics, you know. But that was my whole. Yeah, it's thing.
It's also contra naturam. I mean, in the sense of the oldest, you know, against nature. It's against nature for parthenogenesis, for a woman to just give birth without, or any organism in nature to give birth without having a fertilizing intrusion, if you will. Although there are, I guess, seahorses or something like that, they do. There are, of course,
seahorses
to the rule that actually do self.
I was going to say something, but I forget what I was going to say. As we've mentioned, let me just throw it out. As we've mentioned, this was a necessary. You know, this is Ion. This was a necessary development, the split. But did it have to be so big? You know. And now it's only time to come back and try to synthesize them.
Why was it necessary then? The ego was
strong? Well, the idea is that this Sophia experience, or this instinctual experience, was so strong that the ego wasn't capable of controlling it.
Okay.
So at the beginning of the Roman era, instinctual decadence was so prevalent that there had to be a swing and a separation and the sanctification of spirituality and the demonization of matter. Which is then what led to the monasteries and so on, to give the Western ego strength to be able to start controlling itself. Okay. And then I think that's two. Let's see, there's one more thing I wanted to say there. I think that's it. She just makes a reference to water as a parallel to the fact that there's a feminine that brings death and then a feminine that brings life. And throughout our tradition, they have been separated. In Sophia, they come together. And she just says, and you also find that in alchemy, that there is that the divine water is both creative and destructive. Now, that's what's on page 258. On page 259, you get down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In the Turba, Turba remembers that alchemical text. The water is a water of life and also of poison. So it doesn't say any news, he's just bringing in an amplification. That does the chapter. Questions? Next parable. The Gate of Brass. I'll just read you the first paragraph. In the course of the preceding parable, it became increasingly clear that wisdom and the corrupting humor, or the death-dealing woman, represented the same thing. But as in most alchemical texts, the author was not aware he was projecting his anima into matter. Does that make sense? Project his anima into matter? For this reason, she remains unredeemed, caught in the projected state, and not recognized as a psychic factor. And that state of not being available is here symbolized by the prison. How is the prison another image for the flood? And we were saying that each of these parables is going to be a repeat of the attempt at integration. So we're getting another flood, but this time, instead of a flood, we're getting a prison. What's the relationship?
Place you can't get out of.
Yeah.
You're stuck in it.
Right. But we are not stuck in it. She is stuck in it.
Oh, well. Some of us. Sure.
Wouldn't that be kind of very kind of the projected state not being recognized? It's not making the connection ourselves, you know, not being able to recognize when we are having experience. Many people don't make that connection within. It's always out here.
Yes, but I want to hear you say how that is a restatement of the flood. What's the parallelism? Because both of these images in dreams are very frequent. The flood, I mean, you've done any dream work, you've certainly had at least one flood dream. And you've probably had at least one prison dream.
You're not in control.
Yes, right. You're not in control. With the flood, you are overwhelmed by whatever it is, the sexual feeling or the power drive or the depression. And the meaning of the experience is unavailable to you. So you could say the meaning is imprisoned. I've always been fascinated by this prison dream, because I've had quite a few dreams of that myself. And it's interesting, in dreams, it is usually a positive image. You wouldn't think so.
Well, all of them are eventually, because you have to keep supposing it needs to take place, right? It's like that poison and...
And I think it's more. I think it's more.
The prison?
Yeah. Anwar Sadat said, a man can find... You know, he was imprisoned. Mm-hmm. After the war, because he was a Nazi sympathizer, said that a man can find himself in one of two places, in war or in prison. And one of my heroes, you heard me talk about Václav Havel, he's the president of the Czech Republic, I think he still is, he was imprisoned. If you ever had a Pilsner Urquell, in the prison in the town where that beer is made, He was imprisoned in Pilsen and for quite a few years, and he has a marvelous book called Letters to Olga, Letters to His Wife, from his imprisonment. He was a playwright. He was imprisoned for his activities against the state, the communist state. And he writes in there that he is not upset about being in prison because it actually seems to him strange that it took so long for him to end up in prison, because he feels it was part of his fate. That's a great man speaking. He must be an amazing human being.
I think you had a story in Branches, too, not too long ago about that. It was similar, a man being in prison, but having the great experience of finding love, and love appeared to him. And the great, you know, I mean, as far as being in prison, the things that we're saying, that is, to me, the positive, it's the potential of... You know what I mean? Wouldn't that be part of that, being in prison where you totally have control, but you still can...
Well, what I understand it to mean is that you are, to the ego, service to the self feels like an imprisonment.
But it can be set free within that prison.
Part of our job in this work is to help people come to terms with what the self is asking so that it is a service freely rendered, and not something that feels like an imprisonment.
And wouldn't that part of the blossom be too, is coming in touch with your true nourishment? You don't, you have nothing external to grab onto you. Being in that prison.
Yeah, I would say that's being imprisoned in the path that the self is laid out. And here I think, in a way, it's similar. Her imprisonment in the story, we said, is like the unavailability of the meaning when the first stage of this process is raging. And I would also see that as a protection. That what Sophia has had to offer us, we have not been ready to receive. So she had to remain imprisoned up to now. But now it's our job, now back to the text. He who break in pieces my gates of brass and my bars of iron. So what Sophia is asking for in the text is the release of herself from imprisonment. In other words, we translate that, the discovery of meaning from the experience. And those of you who know T.S. Eliot know that wonderful line, we had the experience but missed the meaning. That's what we're trying to get at, that there is a difference between an experience and the meaning of an experience. And she is asking us to not just experience things, but to struggle with that experience to find the meaning. And what's the meaning? The meaning would be how this experience is meant to convey to you a piece of your identity, as we've talked, which is required for the next challenge that fate is putting in your path. So it starts with sex. It starts with power. But it ends with purpose. And that would be the union of Mary and... of Eve and Mary. Do you have a stretch?